Okay, recording on the cloud. Good job, everybody. Good morning. It's good to see you all. We're back here at Matan on Zoom studying Judaism and the isms. And this week, we're going to study something that has been in the news, that has been all over the news, everywhere in the news, not just in America, but in many places around the world. And that is the topic of Judaism and racism. And so now I'm going to mute everybody. But if you need to say something, you want to share comment, questions, you know, just press on the space bar and we'll be able to hear you. Good. And don't, you know, feel free to speak up and share questions if you have. Okay, so the way I want to do this, I want to focus on, I'm not sure if some of you are aware, but a great, great Jewish leader passed away this last week. His name is Rabbi Dr. Norman Lam, a phenomenal, phenomenal Jewish thinker. If you have not read any of his books, you owe it to yourself to go on Amazon or Book Depository and buy some of his books. Norman Lam, I would say his most famous book is probably Torah Umada, in which he writes about the, you know, very, in a very systematic way, about modern Orthodox theology and about this notion of combining wisdom, secular wisdom, and Torah wisdom. He's the one who's done the most research on this, and he's a phenomenal writer. He's almost poetic in his writing, his writing style. He wrote, I think, 18, 19 other books. He planned originally to be a chemist, and they realized that it would be a real waste of a mind if this person didn't become a rabbi and a huge Talmud Chacham and a Jewish philosopher. He has an amazing book on the Shema. He has a book for young couples who are getting married. He has books on Jewish thought. He has a series of essays called 70 Faces, which has many of his essays. And we also have, and I'm going to share this link with you because this is just such great material. They have a collection of his sermons, okay, online. He over 800 different sermons that he gave over a period of time. I'm going to share with you the link. And this is really a really valuable resource. And let me just share it here on Zoom. Share it in the chat. And you can go to this link and look up any topic, any parsha, any chag, and you will find material that will be illuminating and insightful and penetrating. And, you know, he's dealing with, from the pulpit, he is addressing issues of modernity, consumerism, communism, this creation of the state of Israel, mass communication, all of these changes that started in the 50s and 60s, mass commercialization, he's already addressing, and he has such prescient insight. He's almost prophetic. So we're going to look at his views, and more generally, Judaism and racism. Now, very often, this discussion comes up in the context of, is Judaism racist? We believe in this notion of being Am HaNivchar. We are the chosen people, Mamlechet Kohanim, the Goy Kadosh. Does that mean that we espouse some form of racism? And it's in that context that we often talk about this topic. Rabbi Lam does address that issue in one or two of his drashot, which we'll take a look at as well. And there's another area where he addresses racism, and that is, I mean, he was talking about rabbis speaking about politics from the pulpit. And he did it so brilliantly, so you can't really be upset at him for it. But when, after the racist Zionism is racism, declaration was made, you know, the most, you know, pathetic resolution of the United Nations. He gave a drasha called "Dear Fellow Racists." That's the drasha that he gave to his congregants. So, but the main area where he addresses this is in terms of what's happening in America in the 60s. There's upheaval, the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King. Many of you, I'm sure, remember this. Some of you also lived through or experienced certain aspects of apartheid. And so that's another conversation that we'll bring together, because Rabbi Norman Lam went to visit South Africa in 1964, and he shares some experiences and insights after seeing South Africa. So at the outset, I do want to give Hakarat HaTov to Rabbi Shalom. I think he's a Rabbi Shalom Lam, who's a family member of Rabbi Lam, who wrote a really fascinating article on Rabbi Lam's anti-racist ideology. I guess I'm sorry for giving away what his views are on racism, that he's going to be anti as opposed to pro, which, you know, but we're going to, you know, so I've used that for some research, but I've also done some other research to bring together a number of his drashot that discuss these different issues, and they are unbelievable. So let's jump right in. So I'm gonna share the source sheet on our screen here. Let me just find it in my different windows here. Here we go. Okay. And let me share.
Excuse me, Rob. Reuven David, yeah. Can you just confirm that link that you just shared was to his collection, not
his collection. Exactly. It's his collection of sermons.
That's fine.
Yeah. It's his collection of sermons, and there are 800 of them, and they are all, one is better than the next, let me tell you. Okay. So let's start with number one, the religious foundations of business. This is a sermon, I forgot to put the date. I think it was 1963 that he gave this. And as we'll see, his ability to draw out ideas from the Torah and apply them to modern day issues is just unbelievable. So let's look at, we're in Dvarim Parakafe. In Dvarim Parakafe, the Torah talks about the commandment, the prohibition of not having false measures. If you own a business, if you work at the shuk, and you have measures that are false, Rabbi Lam, the Torah tells us that you're engaging in an abomination. Look at Dvarim Parakafe Pasuk Tzayin, Ki To'avat Hashem Elokecha Kol Osei Eila. You're not even allowed to have these measures in your house. You can't have smaller measures because you might cheat somebody. Now, this is, okay, a person should be ethical in business. Very nice. There are a number of halachot in the Torah that talk about this. But then the Gemara says something which is just absurd when you hear it for the first time. Amar Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Levi says, Kashe onchan shel midot yoter me'onchan shel arayot. Rabbi Levi says, it is worse to have false measures than it is to engage in adultery. Okay, now that's hard to believe. You know why that's hard to believe? Because we know that one of the big three in Judaism is what? What are the big three? Who could tell me what are the big three?
Murder, Avodah Zarah,
and what do you need to do with these big three? These big three commandments. It's better to die than to kill someone else. Better to die than commit adultery. Better to die than worship Avodah Zarah. You want to tell me that having false measures, if I end up stealing one date or a few extra, you know, some extra grain, you're going to tell me that's worse than adultery? I mean, what's this world? What's happening? This is crazy. This is unbelievable and incredulous. Now, what is the meaning of this statement? So the Netziv of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin shares the following insight. And again, this is all part of Rabbi Lam's Drasha, and we will look at his own words in just a second.
Can I interrupt with a technical tip? You can get rid of this piece of the screen with export PDF and edit PDF. You'll have more room for the text will get bigger.
Oh, good idea.
There's the arrow in the middle. There's a triangle pointing to it. Go to the left. The left? Yeah, that column right there. Right, yeah, that's it. No, that triangle.
Okay. That better? Yeah. That better?
Yep.
Okay, good. Thank you for the insight. Okay, so the Netziv, in his commentary in Sefer Dvarim, notes the following. He says there are three primary reasons why a person sins. There are three passions, there are three desires, three things that human beings that it compels to sin. Number one is lack of faith in Hashem. Okay, number two is desire, that we want things. Desire, the Yetzer Hara. And number three are bad midot. Okay, anger, bad midot, bad character traits. Now, we have three mitzvot, by the way, three prohibitions, which are represented, you know, in each of these. When it comes to not believing in God, you know, denying God's existence, that's Avodah Zarah. When it comes to the ultimate sin of lust, of desire, is adultery. And the third sin of bad character traits, anger, is shvichut damim. Okay, these are all the roles. You know, you have three primary colors. You have three primary motivations to sin. Okay, now obviously the worst of these is avodah zarah. That's the worst. That's the most fundamental principle of the Torah. Don't worship idols. God exists. Don't worship idols. Now, look. Let's see what the Netziv says. The Netziv points out that why he's going to try to explain the statement in Bava Batra. He says, "Aval ha'oseh." The pointer here. "Aval ha'oseh mishkalot sheker." Eino midarach ha'tava, ela michasaron emunah b'Hashem. Here's the insight. When a person has false measures, that doesn't come from a desire to want more. It's not like stealing. You know, I see someone's iPad, I decide to take it from them. That's not this. When a person has false measures and their entire business is built on deception and stealing on a consistent daily basis from every customer that they have come into their shop, that's not a sin of lust. That's not a sin of the Yetzer. That is a sin of denying the existence of God. That goes into the first category, not into the second category. That's a chisaron emunah b'Hashem. This is why the Torah says in a number of places, v'yareita me'alohecha. Remember, there's a God who sees everything. By doing this, you're showing there's no late dayan, late din v'late dayan. I could do whatever I want. And this falls into the category of avodah zarah. And that's why having false measures is worse than adultery, because it's avodah zarah. And avodah zarah is always higher up on the totem pole than lust. Okay, everyone with me until this point? Okay, yes, thumbs up. Yeah, okay, good. Now we're going to see what Rabbi Lam does with this. And this is where you see his brilliance. Let's continue in the source sheet. Okay, we're going to go to the next page. Now, he says, here Judaism reminds us, and what's cool about this is that these are the original pages that were typed out, and you see sometimes adds in words. So here you have a different gear set that he adds in after the printout. So here Judaism reminds us that normal business ethics is essentially more a fundamental, the problem of isolated crimes of passion and violence, is more than the fundamental problem of isolated crimes of passion and violence. It reminds us that there is a religious foundation of business, and that is the pervasive faith that the Almighty is a zan, a feeder and supplier of all humans, without relying upon dishonesty and unethical behavior. And now he's going to talk about the Civil Rights March in Washington, which is undoubtedly a high and glorious point in the history of our country, should set us thinking in the same direction. The crux of the issue is not so much freedom now for the Negroes, as self-respect, and by the way, this term Negroes obviously is out of use. I'm using it because it's here in his sermon. This is a term that was used back in the day. As self-respect and dignity now for the white majority, which allowed such disgraceful discrimination to continue unabated for 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. So he's saying right now, these issues, civil rights, it's not so much about free. It's some element is about freedom for the blacks, but it's also about the fact that if any whites want to have self-respect and dignity, they've got to address the disgraceful discrimination of 100 years of racism. It was bad enough when hate-frenzied mobs lynched individual Negroes. But this crime of shvichut damim is exceeded by the greater blood on our record. So he's saying, listen, lynchings are obviously terrible. No one would, but the one-off lynchings here or there, whatever amount there were, and it was more than just one, that's not as systematic a problem as the methodical economic exploitation of one segment of our population, the systematic oppression of one race as the source of cheap labor, and its designation as the first to suffer in any economic recession. When the economy of a great nation is built upon such patent injustice, it is a crime of avodah zarah. Now, I wish I could share with you more of the history. To be honest, I don't know all the history myself, but I've seen it mentioned that many of the bills that were pushed forth in Congress in America over the last century, the GI Bill, for example, after World War II, they left out blacks. So, whites were able to buy a house and make a living after World War II and build a family, and blacks were left out of these economic opportunities. And, there are many such examples. When the economy of a great nation is built upon, said, okay, now it is a breach of faith. It bespeaks lack of faith in God, who is Av, Echad Likulanu, our one father for all humans, making us all brothers. It is a lack of faith that democracy can really function as its advocates claim for it. And it is not merely a propaganda term in power politics. It is a lack of faith that America can live up to its full destiny as a beacon for all peoples, opening new horizons of hope for the oppressed of all the world. So this is a fascinating idea. What Rabbi Lam is saying here is that the sin of racism is not just about lust, wanting, you know, to, you know, have more for yourself. It is avodah zarah. Racism is equivalent with avodah zarah. That is a very strong statement. And again, we see the basis, the conceptual framework for coming to this conclusion. You know, it is interesting to think about. I mean, we'll pause here for a second. I'm curious, what do you think about racism in the Jewish community? Do you think this is in general an issue? Do you think it's a minor issue, a major issue? You know, where do you think, how do you think, you know, your fellow Jews, you know, talk about these issues? I'm just curious to hear your perspectives. Anybody?
It's prevalent. I shared on Facebook an article written by a black guy who converted to Judaism, mm-hmm. and his experiences. And even when he was standing outside an apartment block where he was living after he'd converted, he was told, you know, he was looked at and said, what are you doing here? You know, you have no place here. And when he said, you know, well, I actually live here, the guy realized he was Jewish and then invited him for Shabbat lunch. But the blackness came first and then the Judaism.
Yeah. And I just want to unpack that for a second. The obviously that initial response to someone is deeply troubling. And you know, I think it's important to understand that, like, there are different levels of racism in a person's consciousness. You know, what I think, if I had to imagine what happened in that situation, I want to give that other Jew the benefit of the doubt to some degree. What he did at the outset was somewhat racist. You know, he shouldn't have judged him that way or assumed that someone who's black couldn't live in that apartment building. But there may have been a little bit of an attempt for tikkun there and say, well, you know, I can't believe I just did this, you know, welcome to my Shabbat table. That's the most charitable reading. The less charitable reading is, we're racist until someone's a Jew, you know, but I'd like to think a Jew would have a little bit of, guilt about doing something like that. And that's how that played out. But Nachon, that's an example that's important. Fermet, what do you have to say? Now you gotta press the space button. You gotta hold it down. Hold down the space button. Okay, I'm going to unmute you. Okay, yeah. For some reason.
That's it.
Yeah, okay.
No, I just think it's really strange. I mean, you're from America, I'm from England. There weren't a lot of black Jews in our day. You can't help it. And I know black women who have converted. They can't help it when they're at a simple and somebody thinks they're the waitress. Yeah. We're so conditioned. I don't think it's being racist.
Well, no.
It's so unusual to see. And yes,
you're raising a very good question. First of all, there aren't so many black Jews in America either, by the way. They're not a lot. I remember you'd see on the West Side, you see some people, but not a lot for sure. And then the West Side is more cosmopolitan of a Jewish community than you go to when you go to the suburbs. So what do we call? What would you call that? I wouldn't call that like deep-seated racism. But I think
we programmed.
What do you call that programming? Let's talk about that. What is that?
Look, I think racism to a certain extent can be programmed. And I think part of the problem with racism is that sometimes, because it is so programmed, we don't realize it. I want to give a personal example. My son was in the hospital. He was going in for a procedure. And I went into a room to see what was going on because I hadn't heard anything. And I automatically went right up. There were two women there. One looked Arab, one looked Jewish. I automatically went right up to the religious one, to the one that looked Jewish, and asked what was going on. And she says, well, you have to speak to the nurse. The nurse was the Arab woman. And I felt terrible after that. It was an automatic assumption when I went in that the Arab woman was the cleaning lady. Now, the truth is that sometimes things aren't racist. My daughter was murdered in a terrorist attack. So you view people or a people or a culture that sanctions and does such things totally different than you view other people. Mm-hmm. So there are very often legitimate reasons why people feel the way they do. On the other hand, sometimes it's so ingrained And it was just an automatic assumption on my part about the nurse not even connected to what happened with my daughter. And afterwards, I realized that, you know, I made this assumption. Where does it come from? And is it racist? I don't know. Maybe it is.
But it can go on to sexism as well. If you see a male and a female, you think the male's the doctor and the female's the nurse.
Right.
So Chava, first of all, I want to say, you know, first of all, a few things. Thank you for sharing this. And I in general, our heart goes out to you about, you know, hearing the story about your daughter. And but back to the nurse for a second. You know, I had a similar situation. I want to compare these. Sometimes I'm at like a store, I don't know, whatever shop, Superfarm or wherever it is. And you think that someone works in the store, somehow they have a certain authority to them. And you go up to them and you say, oh, where can I find a toothbrush, you know, in the store? They're like, well, I don't work here. Now that person could be white. It could be white. It's nothing to do with, that's not racism. That sometimes we just make, you know, bad judgment calls or make assumptions. And that's not necessarily coming from a racist place. I think that's true. And all the more so when the majority of people in a hospital happen to be Arab, not saying it's anything essential to who they are. So you're more likely to think that, you know, maybe that's why you have that. So that's not necessarily, I agree that that's not necessarily racist. And it's possible in the case that you brought up, Leslie, that, you know, somehow that black Jew was doing something that looked threatening. I'm just throwing out an idea. It might not be the case, but that's how the Jew might have perceived it. And they might have perceived. Now, the question is, though, are they perceiving something different because this person is black versus because the person is, you know, doing something threatening? And, you know, and I think it's very important to understand that to label everything racist is a deeply mistaken.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So label everything one racist.
One has to be very nuanced. I mean, having grown up or lived in apartheid South Africa till I was more or less 40, I'm going to actually keep my mouth shut because I don't know what there is to say about it. I could write a book. But recently, my daughter was at a wedding in Johannesburg with her little girl.
Yeah.
And a little girl wanted something, and Shana said to go ask the waiter. And she said, who's the waiter? And my daughter said, that black man there. And the guy behind her turned round and gave her an absolute lecture. We don't talk about blacks anymore. That's a racist statement.
Huh.
It wasn't at all. It was a descriptive statement to a little girl. That black man there is the waiter. So one has to be very nuanced, as I say, having grown up in South Africa. You have to be nuanced in what you call racism today or you know, anything like that.
Correct. I mean, I think we all do make, listen, I was in the car yesterday with a friend. We were traveling to go play basketball and there was some car in front of him and the car was stopped in the middle of Rehov Bar Ilan. And he said, and he's like, screams in the car, what's going on, man? You know, like, you know, it's just like, you know, sometimes you say that when you're frustrated in the driving. And as we drove past the car, it happened to have been a woman. It wasn't a man, it was a woman. So, you know, does this suggest that he's, you know, like what is, you know, there are certain things we're just used to things being in a particular way. Obviously, there's a major difference between, you know, there are levels of the degree to which these things are part of our consciousness and our programming. I think the challenge that all of us have is to sometimes reassess, to think about, constantly think about how we're programmed to try to, you know, to be a little bit more sensitive to the degree that we can and to question certain instinctive assumptions that might come up in our mind that we need to just, you know, think about a little bit more carefully. You know, so that's what I think, you know, some of this demands. What my lamb is talking about here is government policies right now. What he's talking about is that, you know, have policies that, you know, he's sort of exploiting one particular group. Obviously what happened in America was at least in the last 100 years was less worse than what happened in apartheid South Africa. Although 200 years of slavery was pretty serious. It was very, very serious. So there, you know, but the first piece, religious foundation of business is how a government, how a society generally functions. We're going to get down to how an individual, you know, might need to address some of these. So let's keep going. Okay. I'm going to go back to the shared screen here. And we
can I say something? I think racism, when it comes to Judaism, is totally different from racism as others perceive it. Because on the one hand, it does say Goy Kadosh Mamlechet Kohanim. And yes, we do have Atem Or LaGoyim. So we do have a certain feeling of being a special people. Ata b'chatanu mikol ha'amim. That is very much ingrained in us. And therefore, we do have a certain... But beyond that, and again, just a very quick story, we rented an apartment when we first came to Israel. And then we weren't sure when the place we were moving would be ready. So I said to the man, I can't, you know, doesn't matter if I stay a few more months. And he said, fine, as long as I can show the apartment. And I said, certainly. And then somebody came to see the apartment and they asked me, are there Iraqim here? And I said, well, how would I know? And I went to my next door neighbor, a very lovely woman, and I said, tell me, are there Iraqim here? And she looks at me and she laughs. She said, Shoshana, if I did not know you well, I would be very insulted. You don't know that we're Iraqim? I said, how am I supposed to know that? I'm an American. There's Jews and there's non-Jews. That's it. No other differentiation. So I think many Jews, or at least maybe I'm just speaking for myself, if you're, there's category one, you're Jewish. I'm Nifchar. Category two, everybody else whose purpose in being is to get up to the status of Kol Amim Yavo LeYerushalayim, of getting up to the status of Am Nifchar. But among them, there's no difference. The same way the Kohanim are special, but that does not mean that there's anything, all the other Shvetim are equal. The Kohanim are special, I'm Kadosh, but all the others are equal. Now, I feel that many Jews, as I said again, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm only speaking for myself, but many Jews have the feeling that if you're not Jewish, then you're all the same. I don't see any difference.
Interesting. Okay, interesting. Okay, let's move on to drusha number two of Rabbi Lam. This is called Insights into Evil. This is from February 29th, 1964. And here Rabbi Lam elucidates the story of the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, and specifically Aharon's role in it. Now this drasha shares tremendous psychological insight. I mean, it's really powerful what he does here. So the story of the Chet HaEgel is confusing, and how could the Jewish people possibly commit the sin so soon after Har Sinai? And Aharon's behavior is even more confounding, because you'd think Aharon would come out and say, hey, there's no way that we're allowed to build this, but he seems to go along with this project. You know, the people are getting antsy and impatient. But here's what happens. So in Pasuk Alevayar, Am Kiboshesh Moshe Laredim Minahar, Ba'ikel Am Al Aharon. So the people were getting impatient. And what did he do? One second, I'm just going to mute everybody all right now. Okay, Vayikael Amal Aharon, and they congregate on Aharon. They put a lot of pressure on him. Vayomru Elav Kuma Seilano Alima Shviyachul Lefanenu, and they said, let us make a god who will walk before us, or a leader, a god. Kizem Moshe Isha Shalana Meifran Leyadan Lemer. Oh, we don't know where Moshe is. What's happened to him? So Vayomru Alehem Aharon Pirkuniz Meazam Asher Beosnei Neshechem Bneichem Uvnotechem VaHaviu Elai. He says, okay, we're going to make an art project. Bring me all the gold from your daughters and your wives. They did this, they bring him all the goods. So he then made this egel masecha. It's not clear what his intention was here, but clearly was not for idolatry. It was somehow to sway them, to maybe use this as a tool to worship Hashem. But they're the ones who said, Vayomru, Eilo alecha yisu asher alucha me'aretz Mitzrayim. The Jewish people start to worship this, and they see it as, you know, as a god of sorts. Now we have the key pasuk, Vayar Aharon, and Aharon sees Vayar Aharon, Vayivan Yizbeach Lefanav, Vayikra Aharon, Vayomar Chag LaHashem Machar. Aharon sees. What does Aharon see? Can you tell me, what do you think Aharon sees at this moment? And then what does he call it? He builds a Yizbeach, and he says, tomorrow we're going to make a Chag, a festival to Hashem. What does Aharon see at this moment? Anybody? So according to the Ramban, this is the Peshat, Ramban says, Tam zeh katuv shara otam biram mechavnim ela egel v'kam ubanam izbeach. He sees that they have bad intentions. He didn't have these intentions, but they have bad intentions. And therefore he says, you know what? Let's redirect this. Let's rechannel our energies to create a chag for Hashem. That's Ramban. And that's the Pshat. Now Rashi is going to give us a midrash, which is what Rabbi Lam is going to use to analyze this issue. Bayar Aaron shehaya baruach chayim. Aaron sees that the Egel now had come to life. Shana Amar, as it says, B'tovnit shor ochel esef, like an apparition, an image of a shor of an ox eating grass. V'ra'asheitzliach maseh ha-satan. He sees that the Satan has succeeded. V'lo haya lo pelit chotam negamre. And Aaron realized he didn't really have the power to stop this. He sees that the eagle is turning into something real. It's coming alive. It's alive. That's what Aaron sees. Now, what does Rabbi Lam do with this? Okay, and this is brilliant. He says, whenever we encounter an ideology in life that is problematic, that is morally bankrupt, communism, Nazism, whatever it is, okay, socialism is different, but any of these things, our immediately instinctual reaction is revulsion. Oh my God, that's revolting. I could never be connected to this ideology in any way whatsoever. Okay, Karen, in 1 second, okay, I'll let you comment. This is the first response that a person has, immediately moral revulsion. But then a person goes through a second stage of thinking, and we'll see a third as well. What's the second stage of thinking? The second stage of thinking is that a person starts to realize, you become acquainted with, you start to realize, you get used to, you come to realize, well, this ideology that I thought was really bad, well, there are actually some justifications, there's some logic to it. There's some, seen from another angle, it seems sort of compelling in a way, okay? And you start to go through the justifications, the rationalizations. That's the second stage. The third stage is where a person comes around and recognizes that no matter how compelling, how logical this idea is, ultimately it is morally revolting and I need to reject it. And so the first and the third stage are similar in terms of, you know, coming back to the same mindset, but you go through stage two where you process it a little bit more and you know, you still have to get through to stage three. Now, what are we talking about here? Rabbi Lam talks about his experience of going to visit apartheid South Africa in 1964. And his first immediate reaction was, this is a morally revolting. However, after being there and seeing the place and listening to the way people talk, he said, well, you could start sort of justifying it in a way. You justify it because he said, well, blacks are not, they weren't here originally either. They're from other parts of Africa. It's not like the whites are dominating the local, the native black population that's been here for 10,000 years. They also are recent immigrants of this country. That's one justification. Justification number two, these people are illiterate. They don't know anything. You really think they should be given the right to vote? They don't understand politics and economics. You're going to have these people vote? No, it doesn't make sense to have the blacks vote. Justification number three is, well, you know, it may be tough to be a black in apartheid South Africa, but it's much worse to be in the Congo. It's much worse to be in East Africa or Zambia or Zimbabwe. Those are much worse places. At least in this country, there's structure. There's, blacks have some form of power. It's just not as much as whites. So these are all the different justifications and rationalizations that a person can go through when it comes to when encounter apartheid. But ultimately, Rabbi Lam says, you have to come. Now, why is this relevant to Aaron? Because for Aaron, this is the second stage. Vayar Aaron, Aaron sees the chet, the eagle has come alive. This refers to the second stage when Aaron starts to think, oh my God, maybe this thing makes sense. But then what happens, Aaron comes back and he says, Chag Vayar Aaron, Aaron sees, this is idolatry. This is a bankrupt ideology. I need to reject this. And Vayar Aharoni says, Chad l'Hashem achar. And that's the same thing. That's what Rabbi Lam says. We have to come around to the third stage and say, no, I don't care what justifications, what rationalizations you give for this. This is totally wrong. Okay? And this is what he says. Let's read. This development of insight into evil refers not only to ancient, but to modern idolatries as well. Whether it is scientism or materialism, communism, or even godless humanism, the same three stages are required of man. The first, where you acknowledge immediately its absurdity and fallacy. The second, where you begin to appreciate the rationale and explanation. And the third, where with a great deal more sophistication, you rise nevertheless to the moral heights of rejection. And the same development must apply to one of the most pernicious and idolatrous, again, doctrines in the memory of living man, one that has caused untold grief to uncounted millions in our century, that of race superiority and race inferiority. Now he's going to talk about racism. My recent trip to South Africa, listen to what he says about the country, left me overwhelmed by the exhilarating beauty of the country, its great wealth, the abundance of its natural resources. Anyone who has been to South Africa knows what he's talking about. And yet I had a feeling that it is a tortured country, gripped by a tragic agony that dominates all thinking, underlies all conversations, and pervades all policies in this highly politicized community. The race problem is a pall that, in this land of magnificent climate, almost endless sunshine, darkens the heart of the country from one end to the other. The reaction to apartheid, the doctrine of separate development of the race, is based upon the idea that the white race is superior to the one non-white, must also go through these three stages. Okay? Now, how does this relate to racism in America? Who would like to volunteer and read? Anybody? It is true? Do I have any volunteers?
I'll read.
Okay, go for it, Danny. It is true.
It is true that we New Yorkers must not rush overzealously to condemn and criticize those in other states, let alone other lands, for without in any way favoring or denying the claims of certain Negro groups, which may or may not be justified, we certainly have not been blemishless ourselves, and our race problem is far less severe and threatening to us than in South Africa. Nevertheless, wherever one oppresses another and shuns him because of the color of his skin, wherever one man denies another the benefit of his own labor and the right to the bounty of God's nature because of race or religion, whether it be in Georgia or Johannesburg, in Corona or Cape Town.
In Corona. Times of Corona. Look at this. Look at the
prophet.
We're reading this now in times of Corona. Go for it.
It is idolatry because it denies the Father of God. This is an affront to Torah because Torah recognizes only one apartheid, that between Tamei v'Tahor, between pure and impure, good and evil, gentle and wild, malevolent and benevolent. We Jews who have suffered so from silence, from the silence of popes and presidents and organized populations during the time we needed help, when our families were slaughtered by the millions, we especially must not keep silent when an injustice is committed against others in our presence.
Okay, so Rabbi Lam is saying, you know, this means that we need to speak out again, this notion that racism is idolatry. This is powerful, that the only apartheid in the Torah is between good and evil, as opposed to any other types of apartheids. But you see some of his poetry here. The race or religion, Georgia, Johannesburg, Corona, Cape Town. He's got a lot of these play on words throughout his sermons. Okay, so this is number three. This is sermon number two. Now let's move on to sermon number three. Now I am curious, and Marilyn, maybe you could speak to this point. What were some of the justifications that people gave in South Africa, at the time during apartheid?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Rabbi, one has to know that it was beneficial to everybody to grow up in a home where your nanny looked after you and didn't look after her children and cooked and cleaned daily, every day, for a pittance was beneficial. The fact that very many Jewish industrialists and Jewish businessmen paid a pittance to their black workers and became very comfortable and wealthy. So there was a lot of, there were benefits. Yeah. On the other hand, most of the Jewish anti-apartheid workers who landed up either in jail or running for their lives were not religious Jews. So one has to ask, where were the rabbis? What were they saying? Why were the religious Jews so comfortable with this abhorrent way of living? So, one was, to the extent that you could be, kind and good to the people that you employed. Some people weren't. That goes without saying. But nevertheless, one became, as I grew older from a little girl into a university student, I was anti-apartheid. You began to understand how evil it was. On the other hand, the people at the Afrikaans-speaking universities, who were just as educated and just as intelligent, et cetera, they were very pro-apartheid because they had this whole religious feeling that they were being good to these people by bringing these uncivilized brutes into a Christian world and into civilization. It is so complex, and it's such an emotionally laden kind of debate to talk about apartheid even today. But there were justifications. There was the sense of being not patriotism, paternal, being paternal.
Paternalism. Yeah.
It was in the black, in the Afrikaans speaking world, it was most certainly justified in terms of God, in terms of religion, in terms of helping these people come into the world. And I guess the Jewish people just rode on that very comfortable way.
So we're going to talk about Jews in a second. We're going to talk about the Jews in South Africa in particular. But what's powerful here, and Karen, just one second, is that what I find very powerful about Rabbi Lam's analysis here is that he recognizes, he's not dismissing the logic of some of these justifications. Ultimately, he says they are overridden by the moral question. But he says he understands how a person can come to rationalize things. And we all do this to some degree. Mm-hmm. And, it was something, even when I was in South Africa post-apartheid for 2 years in Cape Town, it was amazing to have a maid in your house. I mean, we paid her money. We paid her much more than maybe she would have gotten in apartheid. It was still nothing, though. It was still cheap, very cheap labor, you know. And there were people, I remember, in the community who would have like 9 people gardening their home, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So employ more and more people. But this is, there were definitely benefits that made life a lot easier for Jews and for whites in general. Okay, we're gonna come back to them because we're gonna look at a source by Rabbi Cyril Harris in just a little bit. Okay, Karen, what do you want to say?
Yeah.
Well, there are now 2 things I wanted to add. One was regarding Aaron and the Egel HaZahav, where according to the Midrash, it seemed to come to life and eat grass. It reminded me many years ago there was a children's movie that came out during the December holiday season called The Polar Express.
Yeah.
And my chavruta went to see this with a group of children.
Yeah.
And she said what struck her was that it overturned the seeing is believing, because that was supposed to be the message of the movie, seeing is believing. But she said no, what she came out of it was believing is seeing. And so likewise with Aaron and the Egel, the people believed that this was really a God, and Aharon then saw that in that context it was so, and he realized he had to act. That believing something to be true makes you see it.
Yeah, that's what I think is the pshat of Rashi. That's what I think Rashi is
bringing
out.
So it was interesting to see that in a 21st century context.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I wanted to say about the idolatry of racism. It jumped out and like grabbed me by the hand on Shabbat morning when I was at the Beit HaKnesset HaGadol and I was listening to the parasha, Perek Yud Bet, the very first pasuk, "V'tedaber Miriam v'Aharon b'Moshe al odot ha'isha ha'kushit asher lakach ki isha kushit lakach." And our rabbis bent over backwards to try to tell us, no, it wasn't the fact that she was black that was the problem. It was that he was ignoring her. And Miriam was feeling this moment of women's solidarity. But the plain meaning of the text is that Miriam and, to some extent, Aaron had a problem with the fact that Moshe married a black woman. Okay, and so what was Hashem's response? Hashem's instant response was, excuse me, I created her. I don't make mistakes. You get Tzara'at.
So,
out of the camp for a week. Beyond the pale.
So that's what I think is the best explanation for that story.
We don't have any better proof that racism is a crime against God.
I mean, that seems to be, and that's what Rabbi Lam is sort of saying. With the Tzibur story, I mean, I think when the Torah, the best explanation I have, I don't know if it's an absolute answer, but in Miriam and Aharon's eyes, they're seeing that she's an Isha Kushit, and there is something, when they're judging her for the character, color of her skin. And yet the Torah at this moment actually says, hey, Moshe is the greatest prophet in the history of the world. So the ultimate, the conclusion of that story is that it doesn't matter what color her skin was or where she came from. And that's really the moral lesson from the story. And that's why Aaron and Miriam are punished. I even saw one idea that she dafka receives tzara'at, which is like white, and that's, there's a, she gets her own skin color becomes discolored in a sense because of this. So there may be a midah keneged midah in the story. Okay, let's move on. There's more to do.
In the light of world current events, that particular pasuk just jumped out and shouted in my face.
Yeah, nachon, 100%. Okay, now let's move on to number three, where we're getting more and more moving from the the government policy to now a little bit more about the individual. Okay, putting a bad conscience to good use. This is sermon number three, delivered in October 1966. Now here we start with a comment by Rabbi Avraham ben Harambam, the student of the Rambam, and he compares in the story of the Akidah. Remember, Hashem tells Avraham, what does Avraham say? Vayomer, he says before this, he says, Hineni, I am here. What does Hineni mean? Rashi points out, Hineni means I'm ready to go. Whatever you want me to do, God, I'm ready to go to follow your will. Now, the son of the Rambam says, Uma Rav, okay, I'm over here. Uma Rav Hachiluk. Now, Rav Avraham ben Harambam says, well, what a different response between Adam Arishon, who says, well, because I was, after he sins and God says, what do you do? And he says, well, I ran away because I was naked and I hid, versus Avraham, who says, Hineni. Okay? So what a huge marav hachiluk between these two things. Now, Rabbi Lam says, I don't understand the comparison here, because when it comes to Adam, Adam sinned. Of course, he's trying to deny his sin. When it comes to Avraham, Avraham didn't, there's no sin here. Avraham, God said, hey, Avraham, you ready to go? Yes, I'm ready to go. Let's go. Okay, so how do we understand this? So Rabbi Lam comes to the conclusion that you actually need to reread the story of the Akedah in order to understand this comparison. And his reading of the Akedah is as follows, that actually both Adam and Avraham sort of sinned at this moment, and both of them were having stirrings of their conscience, if you will. Okay. Now, we understand why Adam sinned. He just ate from the Chet Ha'Egel. Ate Adam. How did Avraham sin? So Rabbi Lam brings a midrash, that right before the story of the Akedah, Avraham actually threw a major feast, a huge party, a huge festival. And at this festival, he invited all the Gedolim, all the famous people of the Middle East, Og and Sichon and Nimrod, even I think is in the list, and Shem and Abraham, all these different people are invited to his feast. But the problem is that Avraham did not invite the non-important people, the people who don't have big names or, aren't famous. Where were all the Ketanim, the people that Avraham hosted as his in, as for Hachnasat Rachim. Abraham seems to have only invited the important people, and this is sort of the stirrings in his conscience, and that's why Abraham responds Hineni, and that's the difference between them. Both Abraham and Adam sinned at this moment, and the difference between them is Adam is running away, and Abraham, you know, recognizes his sin. Okay, so that's the basis for this. For this drasha. And Rabbi Lamb doubt that, well, when you have a bad conscience, you could choose to do one of two things. When you feel you did something bad, you could deny it, you could flee, you could run away, and that's Adam. He runs away from Hashem. What does Abraham do? Abraham confronts it. Abraham addresses it. Abraham takes responsibility for it. And hence the title, Putting a Bad Conscience to Good Use. Now, what he says here is that now he jumps into the issue of racism. And he says, I would like to state at the outset that I prefer to see the problem in its true perspective without any extremist appeal. We Jews as Jews are not responsible for the conditions of Negroes in the United States. Our grandfathers were not slaveholders who devised this cruel and inhumane system. When the Negroes were being emancipated in the 1860s, we too were being emancipated in the ghettos of Europe. Indeed, on this very day of October 29th in 1833 in Austria, we experienced the very first instance of legal political emancipation. Now, if this is 100% true, I'm not sure. I think there were some Jewish slave holders in the South.
There were Jewish slave traders, Jewish slave owners.
There were. No, I'm in ones, you know, but there were. They existed. So, you know, we have to take this statement. Probably needs to be modified just a little bit. Okay, but we were not the main players in the Civil War and the slave trade, etc. Nevertheless, he says, we have participated in a growing economy which has to a large extent thrived on the exploitation of minorities, and we have shared deeply held prejudices about them. One need not masochistically excuse bigots like Leroy Jones and embrace other fanatics of the Black Power movement in order to appreciate that all whites suffer or should suffer some degree of a bad conscience. He says, it doesn't mean we got to say that every Black out there who's saying even radical things is justified. He doesn't agree with the Black Power movement, but he's saying we should have a bad conscience generally about what's happened, whether we're responsible for it or not. The question is, what shall we do about it? And here's the difference between Adam and Abraham. Adam runs away, Abraham addresses it. Not to feel any guilt, any trouble in the conscience is the sign of our own moral failure. We must experience some hir hurei dvarim, some stirrings of the conscience. Yet to go overboard and dedicate our whole life to civil rights, to make of it an ersatz religion to replace Judaism, to concentrate only on the rights of others while ignoring the preservation of our own community here and overseas, is to lose perspective and to reveal an inner moral weakness while we try to strengthen ourselves morally in some other direction. He says, he's not supportive of this idea of making Judaism is the same as civil rights, and it's only about civil rights, but he says shouldn't be doing anything about this. Okay, now, what's powerful here is, I remembered actually a piece that I once read by Chief Rabbi Cyril Harris in the Truth and Peace Commission when he addressed the Jewish perspective and on apartheid. So listen to what he says. It's sort of similar to Rabbi Lamb. I would like to pinpoint the failings as far as the Jewish community is concerned of all that happened in the apartheid era. The Jewish community did not initiate apartheid. Many in the Jewish community did not agree with apartheid. Almost everyone in the Jewish community had a kind of awkward tension about apartheid. But most of the Jewish community benefited in one way or another from apartheid. So this is the distinction he makes. He says we benefit. I want to read what Stephen Friedman, the director of the Center for Policy Studies, recently wrote. No Jew who lived in South Africa during the apartheid period can plausibly claim, sorry, just apologies, one second. My wife is calling and I just need to take this for one. Sorry about that. Share screen. No Jew, now he quotes is Stephen Friedman. I'm not sure this is the director of the Center for Policy Studies recently wrote, no Jew who lived in South Africa during the apartheid period can plausibly claim that his or her circumstances today are not in some measure or result of apartheid. Anyone who succeeded in business benefited from a right to economic activity which denied others. Anyone who received professional qualifications or had a place at school, college, university, which was denied to them majority on racial grounds alone. Anyone who enjoyed an authentic Jewish family life, Judaism is a domestic religion, did so in a home which persons not classified as whites can neither own nor occupy save as a hired servant. in which latter case they were not permitted to enjoy a family life of their own. Any member who found a job in a corporation or as a skilled artisan probably occupied a post from which those classified not white were barred, etc. So, okay, and he goes on and say, can any one of us, as a matter of principle, since it is possible to determine how South African Judaism would have feared that apartheidism, declare confidently that we enjoy no skills, capabilities, and possessions which apartheid gave us? We bear responsibility today for whatever role we played in the past. However many letters we wrote to the newspapers, however many bursaries we sponsored, however civil we were to our workers or servants, because it is possible, indeed probable, that our personal circumstances are products of apartheid. And if we are responsible for this country's past, we are, of course, responsible for its future, and that the Jewish community benefited from apartheid, apology must be given to this commission. Okay, so this is...
Absolutely.
Say again?
I say absolutely right. In fact, I've often argued with ex-South Africans elsewhere in the world who say, I am this and I am that. And I say, but we all are this and that on the back of apartheid. You can't deny that. You cannot deny. We did get the preference of places in the universities. We did go to the best schools. We had the best doctors. You know, you have to face up to whether you started it and made it. You benefited from it. And there's no doubt about it. But I just want to add one little thing. I know you're running out of time, Rabbi, but incredibly emotional experience I had many years after apartheid. We were in touch with a very, very lovely Afrikaans, very intelligent guy, a business colleague of Monty's. And we were having a chat about apartheid. And when I would be standing outside Wits University with my anti-apartheid placard, he was standing on the other side of the road. He was an Afrikaans guy with a university degree with a pro-apartheid placard. So we were on either sides of the whole divide. And he said something to me. I asked him, I said, the Afrikaans people were so profoundly, their whole way of life, their belief system, their churches was totally enmeshed in the whole apartheid philosophy. And why I asked him that question was because I was thinking, would we as Jews walk out of Israel and say, now, okay, Palestinians, it really is your land? And I asked him this question, and he said to me, you know, Marilyn, more than the blacks were liberated by Nelson Mandela, we, the Afrikaans people, were. And I've never forgotten that, because it just resonated with me how deeply, what a profound statement it was.
Yeah,
because it was their entire raison d'etre was apartheid.
And they had to live with a guilty conscience, which had to be justified, because you can't live with such a guilty conscience.
Mm-mm.
So you rationalize it, and cognitive dissonance has to be resolved. And that's what happens. Listen, the question of I want to hold this, you know, let's have a 3-minute conversation about this, about comparisons between Israel and the Palestinians. I mean, are these the same thing? Are these the relationship between blacks and whites in South Africa, you know, similar to Jews and Arabs in the Holy Land? I'm curious what you think about that.
On a very, very basic level of we saying and believing profoundly and deeply, this is our land, they believe the same. Now, the whole thing in South Africa was, according to the history that I learned as a little girl in apartheid, you know, in the apartheid era, the whites had come in from Europe, and the blacks were moving down from Central Africa, and we met at the Fish River, and there was conflict. According to the black narrative, if you want to call it that, the blacks were there, and the whites with their guns and their sophistication in the 1700s, which the blacks didn't have, and, you know, did what they liked with the blacks. Just on that level, one has to say, okay, this is our land. But they say it's their land. So already you're in this sort of the very basis of the conflict. We haven't treated them, the Palestinians, in the way that the whites treated the blacks. But on that very question of, okay, whose land is it? Can we share this land? It's a question.
Okay, so very, very interesting. You know, I think one difference... There's so much to say about this, and this is, to some degree, this hits at the crux of how the international community looks at Israel, justified or not. because many of them, like, you know, like to say, hey, we're the next apartheid state, essentially, which I fundamentally disagree with. And I disagree with it on many levels. One is because we're always Jews here. It's not like we came and took over land for the Palestinians. There were Jews here throughout the centuries, sometimes less than more, because we weren't allowed to live here, but we were always here and always maintained the connection to the land. You know, fundamentally, I don't think the obstacle to peace right now with Palestinians is Israeli unwillingness to share this land. There certainly are who would not be willing to give up any of, you know, Yehuda v'Shomron, whatever it is. I think fundamentally the problem is the Palestinians have never acknowledged our existence in this land. And
that's right.
And I think there would have been peace a long time ago. The Palestinians would have gotten their state. They would have gotten, we had $100 billion in infusion of money from the international community if they would, you know, stop, you know, trying to, you know, essentially engage in warfare with us. And it's low-grade warfare right now, but we, of course, know what happens behind the scenes. And, you know, there's a lot of things that, that the army deals with that we don't have to deal with. And things, you know, sputter out of control with Gaza every once in a while. But you know, ultimately, it's not really about us not willing to accept them. I think it's more about them not willing to accept us. That's my personal view of the conflict.
I mean, it's a very, very complex issue. But just having listened to that guy sort of having turfed out his whole narrative and belief system because now apartheid was gone, and thinking, if Chas v'Chalila had ever came to anything like that, can I turf out my whole narrative and belief system and everything? Can I do that with grace? And I can't.
This is what you hear in Israel on the left, that as long as we have occupation, Israel will, you know, our sons, our boys are, you know, we are essentially a corrupt colonialist power. Now,
absolutely.
I do agree with you know, the statement of Golda Meir that I could forgive them for, you know, killing us. I can't forgive them for forcing us to have to kill them. And I do agree. I would much prefer to not be in a situation where we have to have control of another population. I would much prefer that. The problem is that we've tried that and it didn't work. The poor Yossi Klein Halevi, someone who I look up to and a real centrist on Israel policies, he says, we learned from the first intifada that we cannot live without a Palestinian state. And then we learned from the second intifada that we cannot live with a Palestinian state. And we're sort of caught in between. And major challenge that we, you know, that we face, that no one wants to occupy, no one wants to, you know, but if it's to save our own kids because of terrorists, well, we have no other option, you know, and then this is
absolutely.
So it is a challenging issue. And I think we also need to always try to maintain our moral
high ground
conscience. You know, we have to make sure that we're doing this in the best way possible. Unfortunately, for better or for worse, this is a war that started in 1948 and hasn't fully ended, even if it's low grade at certain points. And so in that way, it's different.
Long before 1948.
Yeah, long before, correct, long before 1948. So there's obviously a lot more to unpack here. And these are all important and insightful discussions. Now, I just want to finish up. Well, you know, there's this drasha, Sinai burden versus blessing, where Rabbi Lamb speaks about, you know, Jewish chosenness as a responsibility. And actually he addresses the racism issue, but, you know, with being a Jew comes a lot of burdens, you know, and also blessings. But he believes, based on analysis of the bracha of Asher b'charbanim mikol hamim, God's chosen us to take on more responsibility. It's not that we're genetically superior. But now I just want to share with you two last pieces from other drashot that he came up with. One was law and order. Now, this phrase is really key because Mr. Donald Trump has been talking about law and order a lot this week. And law and order was also a phrase that was used in 1968. And, all these riots and looting, and which is some of it which is happening now. The vast majority of people are protesting in America peacefully. But there have been some riots and looting which are problematic. I want to, I would never excuse those, but listen to what he says here. he says, you know, and obviously the Jews who are wealthier were very much supportive of the law and order perspective, because it would protect their businesses, it would protect their wealth, and understandably so. But he says, listen, I would urge you, my dear friends, to be honest with ourselves. Let us all be honest about our motives for calling for greater law and order in the face of the social crisis that besets us. Of course we want law and order. The facile and simplistic answers, social revolution, are there to make up for 300 years of slavery, will not restore his life savings to a Jewish merchant in the ghetto area who was looted and is innocent of any wrongdoing, whose great-grandfather was not a slave trader in the South, but a peddler in the ghettos of Europe. I mean, Rabbi Lam's talking about the Jews came to America in the 1880s, long after slavery had been abolished. It is easy, all too easy, for a white Jewish upper-class suburbanite to excuse the excesses of Negro rioters as long as it is not his store and his savings that have been destroyed. So much so, we must be for law and order and for controlling all extremist groups. Earlier in specific history must not allow xenophobia and fear and racial antagonisms and innate bigotry to emerge in pious disguises. We who have been the perennial victim of cruel governments and established anti-Semitic powers who legislated us into bondage, everything according to the law or which they formulated, we must not allow the cry for law and order to become a tool to be manipulated for unfairness and injustice and oppression. We must, of course, practice enlightened self-interest. But we must not confuse the desire for stricter law enforcement, which is necessary, with the development of a police state. Okay? And one more sermon where he actually quotes and agrees with Malcolm X, who was, you know, believed in, you know, sort of engaging in violence and aggression in order to fight race. Different in this way than Martin Luther King, who believes in peaceful protest. It is for this reason, strange as it may seem, that a white rabbi rises to support the charge of a black Muslim. This is Rabbi Lam. Malcolm X, one of the leaders of this extremist Negro group, has recently criticized President Kennedy. In his talk with Alabama editors, Kennedy did not urge that Negroes be treated right because it is the right thing to do. Instead, he said that if the Negroes aren't well treated, the Muslim would become a threat. He urges a change not because it is right, but because the world is watching this country. Kennedy is wrong because his motivation is wrong. This is what Malcolm X said. Of course, this is an extremist group which in many ways can become quite dangerous. But the argument is right. It is directed not only against our president, but against all or most of us. The first reaction of most of us to the shocking indignities of our Negro fellow citizens are subject to in Alabama was not only revulsion at the cruelty of what was happening, but also the nagging thought, what will the Russians say? What will the neutrals think of us? How will this alter our image in the eyes of free Africa? Our motives were mixed. In fact, had they truly been pure, our government and society would have acted much earlier to put an end to the abuses, the humiliations, the bigotry, which are the fodder for the fanatics' cannon. We would have corrected this ugly situation before it degenerated as it did. So he says we have to make sure that our motives are correct here. One second, I'm just stopping to share this. And we have to recognize a true argument, even if it comes from someone who, you know, Malcolm X is an ideology that's problematic. But you see here Rabbi Lam's moral voice, you know, loudly coming through. I mean, what an unbelievable darshan, incredible insights in his ability to connect Torah values and Torah stories to modern day issues, and his ability to really speak the truth, to speak the moral truth at a time when it was not an easy thing to do. And kol hakavod to him. There's a lot to learn from him to our day today. And I hope we'll continue this discussion. This is an important discussion that we continue to discuss and address. And so kol hakavod for all of you for participating in it. And let's continue the discussion. Next week is our last week together. And we will, please God, we'll have a party. So make sure to bring some cake and coffee. And we'll continue. There's a chance I'm going to be doing a summer series as well. More info to follow soon. So wishing everybody a great day, good week, and please God, we should have peace in our world. Ever the two sides that are involved with all these projects should come to understand each other, and justice and truth should prevail. Okay, kol tov everybody. Wishing
thanks,
you.
Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You'll put it up, please. Okay, great. Don, thanks so much.